The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
It's been a great day so far, and we have, as they say in the business, a strong close. This panel is specifically about various forms of contestation around fan fiction, vids, and related forms of cultural production. Contestation both around specific productions and also, as we're going to see, around genre itself. A lot of it, as it's going to emerge, consists of arguments or the description of arguments about authority, legal authority, cultural authority, economic authority, both formal and informal in its sources. On the resolution or the outcome of these disputes about authority is going to depend a variety of very, very practical issues about the future production of this material, about its circulation, about its interpretation, and about its reproduction. In these contests around authority, there are many participants, and we'll hear about them. There are the proprietors of source texts, a wonderful phrase that I learned here today, and I'm promising to use now forever in place of other less descriptive terms, the makers of these new kinds of productions, the consumers of both source texts and new productions, the commercial imitators of these new genres, and implicitly as well as explicitly scholars, lawyers, experts, and others who have or feel they have some stake in the contests. We're going to hear about a number of general phenomena, recurrent general phenomena in these papers, about the persistent valorization of originary genius, about the regenerative force of hierarchy, especially under market conditions, about the systematic devaluation of women's work, about the difficulty of balancing risk and safety, and also, I think, a little bit about the romance of transgression. And with that, I'm going to stop and go right to these wonderful papers, and first to Abigail. Abigail, we're sorry that you're not with us in person, and we're excited to be trying this virtual experiment. So the floor, if it is the floor, is yours.
Great. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I think there's a slight time between my image and sound, just so you know. I'm watching myself. First of all, I apologize for not being there today due to extremely slow mass transit yesterday from the Bay Area, which got me to the airport 5 minutes after they closed my flight. Many thanks to Francesca, Angie, and to all the other fantastic organizers of this conference, and to Stacey for his technical support to make it possible for me to appear virtually today. Over the last two decades, large swaths of the U.S. population have engaged in copyright wars. On one side of the wars, copyright holders will defend their property against what they perceive to be unlawful appropriation of millions of would-be consumers via digital technology. On the other side, millions of that you fear or fight expensive lawsuits filed by entities far wealthier and more powerful than they that seek to punish them for sharing media online. In this combative climate, fans produce their own version of mass media acts such as fan film, video, fan fiction, fan art and icons, music remixes and mashups, and memes, for example, take comfort and refuge in one rule of thumb. As long as they do not sell their work, they are safe from legal prescription. In other words, the rules of the copyright war was to permit fans to give away the fruit of their labor for free. Free fan labor, that is, fan work distributed with no payment, means freed labor. Fans may revise, rework, remake, otherwise remix as pulled cut without threatening legal action or other interference from copyright holders. Many, perhaps even most fans, who engage in this type of production look upon the field very favorably. After all, movie studios, game makers, record labels do not have to turn a blind eye to fan works. U.S. law is, so far, undecided on the matter of whether appropriative art constitutes fair use for copyright infringement. So companies could sue or otherwise harass and appropriate if they chose. So far, it appears that fans are happy to circulate their productions for free in order to avoid trouble. But even if both sides of the copyright wars consider the issue of fan labor settled, one aspect of the issue has not been fully explored. Can or should fan labor be paid labor? The internet economy depends on free labor, as numerous cultural theorists and business writers have noted. The 2003 essay, Tiziana Perinova writes, simultaneously voluntarily given and unwaged, enjoyed and exploited, free paper on the net includes the activity of building websites, modifying software packages, getting and participating in mailing lists, and building virtual spaces on Mutt and Move. Far from being an unregal empty space, the internet is animated by cultural and physical labor through and through, a continuous production of value. The foundational premise of the concept of Web 2.0 is a dramatic rise in user-generated content. It's difficult to imagine what a people the internet would have without such content consumed daily by millions of people. Fan productions exemplify the unpaid value creation that carefully contributes as a pandemic to the digital economy. Fan productions help to sustain awareness of and interest in asking questions for content by continually fighting off text obsolescence. For example, between the release of a movie's trailer and the opening of the movie itself, or in the days, weeks, or months between new episodes of a television show airing, or in the years between the installments of a serial film or game franchise, any new content related to the original or prior text will likely be fan content. Fans' ongoing discussions and expansions of the universe of particular media production serve to advertise the production of an interim or hiatus periods. Fans' efforts to keep the universe attractive to consumers in times when the official incarnations are absent from the marketplace. If fans of the original 1960s Star Trek had not continuously publicly performed their investment in the Trek universe during the 1970s, it seems doubtful that Paramount would have to revive Trek in the 1980s, following the blockbuster success of Star Wars. Trek fan production was crucial to maintaining interest in the media press that was, for all intents and purposes, dead a decade. And then the marketplace favored reinvestment in sci-fi franchises, the fact that Trek was so alive and so well known, so many, surely informed Paramount's decision to restart the universe. Fan productions not only generate buzz and maintain interest in media productions, they also heighten and extend audience's investment in mass media tests by customizing and tailoring those tests for particular audience segments' take. And they yield crucial data on audience behavior and reactions. All of these functions create value for media producers, distributors, and marketers. Not all fan productions accomplish all of these functions, but most accomplish at least one, and this is not an exhaustive list of the kinds of value creation that are made possible by fan labor. Yet, to return to the beginning of this essay, fans are happy to labor for free. Not all freely circulated cultural production constitutes exploitation. Certainly, many fans have passed the benefit of participating in communities in which money does not factor. Fans take pleasure in helping reviews or create art, and share their work and receive feedback, and exchange their work for gift economy, and or aim for success in a reputation economy. Many fans feel that their productivity is no chore, and therefore not equivalent to labor. Discussions of wages, of payment, and of employment are unnecessary, of this line of thought. However, it is important to bear in mind that fandom is already monetized. Internet is not free space. Site bandwidth must be purchased, and even not-for-profit and website regularly ask participants for donations to assist with the cost of traffic. Many services that quote fan work, Slideable, fanfiction.net, and YouTube are for-profit enterprises whose revenues are driven by fan activity. Fans must produce these things and must consume what other fans have produced in order for these sites to be successful businesses. Money already permeates fan productions. What is disturbing about the free model of fan labor in which fans can get the increased support for mass media products without receiving pay in exchange for the relief they feel at the prospect of never being sued for creating value is that it settles for too little too soon in the ongoing negotiation between the cultural industries, capitals, markets, and individuals. Fan productions and their relationship to, emergence from, impact on, technologies, mass commodities in the marketplace, greatly evolved in the last 20 years under the fuck and still thing. While conceptualizing fan labor as necessarily or essentially free, it both its potential exchange value and its potential positioning is a disciplinary force that might satisfy link desires and as separate from capitalism, as authentic, as consistent in a culture's norms. Such a conceptualization does not match the overwhelming evidence that categories of consumption, production, creation, appropriation, use, and value are highly, currently, unstable. Now I'm going to turn from the general question of free versus paid fan labor to the question of gender in fan labor, and contrast one genre of unpaid female fan labor, fan fiction, to genres of paid male fan labor, such as fan films and game mods. A factor in fanfic authors' unwillingness to consider commodifying their production is the history of fan fiction before and during the early years of the internet. During the years when fanfic was published and distributed only through photocopy scenes, copyright holders, or rather, one copyright holder in particular, George Lucas, set the precedent that developers of the source text that third basis fanfic had the right to determine whether or not fanfiction was permissible, and what kind of fic would be allowed. Henry Jenkins and Will Brooker have chronicled the various directives that Star Wars fic writers received from Lucasfilm ever since the company, holder of all copyrights pertaining to the extensive Star Wars franchise, became fair fanfictions existent in 1977. Over the last three decades, Lucasfilm has run through a gamut of responses to fanfic writers, from establishing a bureau to approve scenes, to forbidding the publication even in free scenes of pornographic fics, to issuing cease and desist letters, to offering to host fanfic a corporate website. All of Lucasfilm's varied stances with an effort to control the circulation of fanfic. The relationship established with copyright holders and fic writers by Lucasfilm's actions was that of firm paternal authority to unpredictably baby children. Brooker writes, for all thought of a Star Wars family, in a 1996 statement issued by Lucasfilm regarding the company's interest in developing guidelines for infant fan activity, Lucasfilm's Buddhist makes it clear that Lucas is still the daddy who can choose to ignore activity if it behaves and crushes when it crosses the boundary. The role of gender in this regulation becomes evident when one considers, as Henry Jenkins points out in several works, that Lucasfilm has treated fan film, made mostly by male fans, very differently than it has fan fiction. And I'm just going to say quickly, since I'm running out of time, that fan film and game mod have been historically accepted by the Lucasfilm community just as soon as they started to be widely circulated on the internet, while fan fiction has never received a warm welcome, and this is primarily attributed to Lucas' identification with young male filmmakers' fan activities and his disidentification with female fans' activities. I've so far suggested only negative reasons that fanfic authors may have chosen not to try to profit from their work, but I now choose to suggest that fanfic writers have also made positive choice by not using their stories to generate revenue, positive in the sense that they have pursued a path that has contributed to their pleasure and happiness. This choice has to do with the idea that we benefit greatly from establishing occupying and guarding safe places in order to freely and discuss their desires and needs. There is a tradition of women's creative work, like quilting, being circulated in informal communities rather than entering the art market, and that's a quote from Michael Willis, a British academic and pick worker. For generations, women have wanted to keep their creative practice unmodified, out of economic circulation, in order to preserve the exclusivity of those areas of cultural production. As long as women's creative work is not bought or sold, it remains, so the art goes, free of public scrutiny and interference. Since men typically rule public sphere while women rule private, by keeping their amateur women supposedly keep it within female control and beyond male control. Of course, the efforts to regulate fanfic production by male-dominated media corporations, just look at stuff, and the fact that women's writing on the internet is so easily accessed by a broad public, throw into question the assumption of privacy, female exclusivity, and safety from men's influence are achievable objections for online fic community. However, it must be acknowledged, and just one percentage, that women parts of past-related societies often decided to leave their labor uncommodified for the maintaining their arts and crafts as a region where they could match female cultural priorities and liberty without external, that is, male, primarily male, censorship. Thank you very much.
I hope, Abigail, that you can stay with us for the rest of the panel and for questions. We'll keep our fingers crossed that the connection remains as good as it has been so far. And I understand that.
Yes, if you want to come back to the Q&A and you'll watch the webcast.
Yes.
Okay, sounds good. Right.
Sounds good. So, Christina, please.
I've never spoken with a microphone before, so you're scared. Okay. As any good English professor, I'll be reading because we don't seem to be able to actually speak freely unless we're Francesca. Thomas Noon Talfour, Member of Parliament and in the early 1800s, one of the early proponents of copyright extensions, found an unlikely ally in his attempts to change copyright protection from 28 to 60 years after the author's death. Not only was William Wordsworth one of his prime examples of true original genius, Wordsworth also supported Talfour in the endeavor to provide lasting copyright protection, in particular to protect the rights of authors who create work of enduring merit. So that was the argument, right? If you create works of enduring merit, you might not actually be recognized during that short time, so it needs to be extended. In his essay, Wordsworth, Copyright and the Commodities of Genius, Richard Schwartz shows how Talbot cannily connects the literary and the legal when he, and I quote here, employs a Wordsworthian rhetoric of literary originality in order to defend the pecuniary interests of true original genius. Throughout his essay, Schwartz convincingly traces Wordsworth's own investment in copyright extension, thus suggesting a connection between the legal notion of copyright and the artistic notion of original genius. In the following, I want to challenge this connection between law and aesthetics and question the emphasis on originality itself. I suggest that following the popularized version of Wordsworth and the Romantics, most aesthetic theories of modernity have been vested in the myth of originality. And I had to put in that popular because one of my romanticist friends said, no, this is not Wordsworth, he's much more complicated. This is just the bad version of Wordsworth. From this mindset, we've inherited the popular belief that continues to value originality and difference even as we've long entered an age of mechanical reproduction, where creativity often takes quite different guises. Such alternate aesthetic value judgments, however, can often be at odds with legal arguments, many of which require some form of originality to counter copyright infringement accusations. Legal arguments that base themselves on transformativity require an aesthetic model where originality is central. And I want to suggest that the connection between artistic originality and aesthetic value is problematic, and the dependency of legal cases on that particular approach to aesthetics limiting. Even as postmodern art and theory values and explicates the artistic engagement of repetition, copy, prestige, and satire, legal and popular notions continue to develop these art forms, decrying them as plagiarism at best, suing these postmodern artists at worst. These various artistic forms of intertextuality that characterize postmodern artistic theory are also at the center of panel works, as fans engage intertextually with their fans in TV shows, movies, or books in terms of expanding, critiquing, and analyzing their worlds and characters. And I'm not saying that it's the same thing, but they are modes that really are similar. Ironically, fans themselves often follow legal trendsetters in their emphasis on originality, thus harking back to more modernist ideals of originality and individual creation. I argue that fan studies in particular must find modes of aesthetic criticism that draw from models not solely invested in modern originality, but instead look towards genre studies and structuralist and post-structuralist approaches to fully comprehend the community-created, highly affective writing fan engagements often produce. In particular, I want to suggest that such alternate aesthetic models are useful not only for fashion academic, but also for legal discourses as they question popular and legal framings that value originality and difference over repetition and familiarity. This essay then is not a follow-up per se. I'm not a lawyer, and after trying to catch up with what you guys write, I don't want to be one. What I want to do here is clearly establish a separation between legal and aesthetic theories to avoid one discipline curbing the other. Or to put it more bluntly, I want to suggest that in respect to aesthetic theory, legal should follow literary discourse, not vice versa. I started with Woodsworth's unexpected connection to copyright because it interestingly suggests that the close ties and interactions between law and literature have historical precedents. Moreover, Woodsworth as copyright extension advocate connects a legal concern with a particular aesthetic approach, often connected to the concepts of the true artist as original genius. It thus represents a specific aesthetic theory that has remained influential upon many widespread understandings of creativity, including those exhibited within many of the copyright cases. In the following, I collapse groups of ideas into a somewhat simplistic binary of repetition, generic tropes, and sameness on the one hand, and originality and difference on the other. In so doing, I don't want to suggest that any writer or literary critic subscribes fully to one extreme or the other. And you can't really find a good quote. I tried. Like, even Kant, even Woodsworth is going to be more complicated than that. Instead, I want to show that literary theory is a constant flux between these two extreme positions, neither of which by itself is ultimately useful. Difference and repetition are both required to create. What this means, however, is that literary scholars and aesthetic theorists don't have unilateral and simple answers. And I'd like to suggest that we should not let legal decisions flatten our understanding of creative works and their respective values, and not give us a definition of peer review that's just beyond anything that. French philosopher Gilles Deleuze describes this inherent duality in his influential 1969 Difference and Repetition. Rather than trying to separate out one from the other, Deleuze argues that they are mutually interdependent, that one can only be understood and perceived in relation to the other, and that both are always necessary. To make this point a bit clearer, language can only ever be meaningful if it is recognizable, that is, if it is repeated, and I think we've read it already today. That is true on the level of the letter, the word, and the sentence, but it's true even on the level of the narrative itself. Tropes function only because readers understand what writers are saying. We can, in fact, understand genre categories as a contract between the reader and the writer, insofar as genre conventions allow readers to establish certain expectations in which to read and understand the narrative. Just like pure difference on the linguistic level would resemble glossolalia, speaking in tongues, a story that doesn't engage any recognizable generic narrative, either by following but also by defining a genre, would create a story that is very difficult to parse for the reader, since all familiar and recognizable narrative conventions are removed. Accordingly, aesthetic theory tends to describe the creative process as an interplay between the familiar and the new. Even writers famous for their focus on individual artistic genius, such as T.S. Eliot, speaks both of, and I of course reference his title to one of his most famous essays here, of tradition and the individual talent. So he emphasizes both parts, thus acknowledging that even the greatest talent creates with and against an existing tradition. However, different periods of literary and philosophical thought place emphasis more strongly on either continuity or originality as they trace creativity between these poles. Thinkers of modernity, in particular, often privilege originality and artistic genius as they laid the groundwork for a value system that still affects the landscape of contemporary most popular culture. I'm talking about philosophical modernity here, so everything's in their life, basically. Frankfurt School philosopher Theodor Adorno articulates the moment of the genius concurrent with the rise of philosophical modernity at the end of the 18th century, and he relates genius to concepts of originality and difference or newness. He says, and I quote, Because of its element of something that had not existed before, the genial was bound up with the concept of originality, thus the, and he uses the German word here, of originalgenie. This then brings us back to Wordsworth proclaiming his originality of the individual author, and as cited here, every author, as far as he is great and at the same time original, has had the task of creating the taste by which he is to be enjoyed. Wordsworth here seemed to bemoan the fact that truly new and great art open took time to become popular, which seemed one of the reasons he wanted copyright terms expanded. And yet, aesthetic concerns clearly were not the only thing at stake here. Juxtaposing Romantic ideology and Enlightenment philosophy with early artistic practices where material was easily repurposed, Adorno emphasizes the historical element of the concept of originality and its socioeconomic connections insofar as originality is enmeshed in historical injustices in the predominance of the bourgeois commodities that must touch up the ever same as the ever new in order to win customers. Here, the concept of the new is intricately bound up with an economic purpose, in the same way copyright laws establish aesthetic criteria for the purposes of secular economic development issues. The historical aspect of this particular view of what makes good art suggests that this is not the only or even the better way of defining aesthetics. In fact, countering this ascribed modernist valuation of originality, postmodern theorists and artists have emphasized prestige abbreviation and intertextuality. And so they revitalize repetition as a central mode of creative production. One postmodern approach transforms older texts through corrective and critical retellings of classic works, and we all can probably tell a bunch of them. The initial impetus of fan writers to want to expand, engage with, or fix media worlds is quite similar to these postmodern modes of transformation. Another similarity is the linguistic and stylistic emphasis on recurrence and repetition. Proto-postmodernist Ramon Queneau's 1947 exercise in Spouse, for example, takes a brief story of an accidental meeting on a bus and retells it in 99 different ways, altering narrative styles in every one of them. Such a celebration of repetition exhibits an impetus similar to that of fan fiction writers, who tell the same story again and again while settling themselves limitations of style laid by narrative devices. And of course, they're all different. You know, that's what you were talking about this morning. Fan writers and artists thus can be seen in this aesthetic framework of challenging themselves to create within firmly established boundaries. As they rework and reshape popular texts, emphasizing and foregrounding their intertextuality, fan texts can be understood as postmodern creations for its loss. Louisa Stein and I have described in a forthcoming article how fan authorship offers a cultural counterbalance to ideologies of originality. We show how fan productions revel in the inspiration born of intertextuality and repeated cultural reference points as they emphasize often voluntarily enforced restrictions to restage common narrative or character portrayals. Is it me?
No, I think the battery's done.
Oh, okay. I'll just speak louder. I can't hear it anymore with the microphone. So repetition can serve a variety of functions that may indeed be necessary for creative works and their reception. First, for one, linguistic repetition is an inherent aspect of comprehensible communication in general, as I've tried to show above. Second, repetition of character setting and plot can be used in specific ways as intertextual engagement. This is most apparent in postmodern criticism and the postcolonial critique Zora Stauffer focused on in one of her essays that I actually could understand of all the law essays I was reading. Finally, thematic repetition in particular can be part of a reader-writer contract and thus is a necessary aspect of particular types of works. This is true for most genre works and applies in particular to fan works. In a recent New York Times article, 5 minutes? Jesus, I have timed myself. In a recent New York Times article, Charles McGraw describes what we look for in genre writing is exactly what the critics sometimes complain about, the predictableness of a formula successfully executed. We know exactly what we're going to get, and that's a seductive part of the appeal. It's why we can read genre books so quickly in such quantity and happily come back for more of the same by the very same author. Such books are reassuring in a way that some other novels are not. What McGraw describes here is a positive look at what usually gets dismissed as repetition. But just like language can only function if words are repeated and recognizable, I'd argue the same holds true for tropes and genres. Even the subversion of generic expectations relies, after all, on the reader's ability to recognize the initial trope and to thus expect certain actions to happen, and it is the refusal to fulfill those expectations that constitutes the subversion. But fan fiction as a genre relies heavily on familiar tropes, to the point of having shorthands and abbreviations for particularly often used plot elements, such as AMTEI, aliens made them do it, or MPREG, male pregnancy, or wingfic. Likewise, there are extensive debates over the conventions of headers, which include generic categories in various ways, including genre, rating, experience, and words, and that's all formalized in a certain way. What this means, then, is that fanfiction as a genre is highly formalized, not only its dependence on the source text, but also in its use of generic tropes. Fanfic, then, is forever caught between the skill of familiarity and the charybdis of originality. And its heart is a love for familiar tropes coupled with a simultaneous desire to find new ways to tell these same old stories. Change too much in the story stops being recognizable as fanfiction. Change too little and it becomes a mere retelling and boring. So unlike most other writings in which originality per se may not be mandatory but can be a good thing, fanfic is predicated on a certain need, desire to return to familiar grounds to recover territory where we've already been. At the same time, this repetition with the difference also opens multiple potentialities of meaning and plot in ways that stories that understand themselves as original do not. Okay, and I have a bunch of stuff here talking about Redway and romance readers, and I'm going to jump right into my conclusion. I have some ideas about what types of studies we should be doing and what the different disciplines are doing, because what's really interesting to me is that reader response theory in English has kind of, you know, been there, done that, old stuff, we're not interested anymore. And meanwhile, media theory, and especially television studies, actually is still doing reception studies going strong, and in fact has gone and done what we, other than Norman Holland, didn't do, and like, you know, who takes Holland seriously, right? Five readers reading, oh wow. So, but television studies does that, right? They go and they do large-scale studies of actual individual viewers, and they look at particular viewers. And a long-term project of mine is kind of to think of fanfiction as a way to look at actual readers reading in particular ways as they view or as they read a text, and kind of bring media studies and English back together in a certain way in reader response. This move between foregrounding repetition and originality in turn is disrupted somewhat when legal discourse valorizes one aspect of creativity over the other. More importantly, if we look at fan works in particular, the emphasis on difference can be dangerous in its need to ignore the value of repetition. And here, unlike Abigail and I, both invited by OTW in a way and at the same time criticizing it, but I am a proud member and supporter. For example, the Organization for Transformative Works, OTW, a nonprofit fan advocacy organization, exemplifies this tension. Although OTW is dedicated to archiving fan works, in all of their repetition and multiplicity, the name itself suggests a valorization of the transformative aspect of fake rape works. OTW's emphasis on the transformative properties of fan authorship is clearly strategic. Its valuation of transformation and implicitly originality reflects a legal culture that upholds values of originality, linking originality with ideas of ownership. But no matter how strategic the rationale, this turn to language of transformation suggests that even in its cultural embrace of repetition, fandom still remains at least tenuously invested in more traditional notions of originality, transformation, and uniqueness. In contrast to such a model of artistic genius, originality, and ownership of individual creativity, I'd like to reemphasize the fan community as a collective creative culture that values sharing, illusion, and repetition as aesthetic and affective choice. While the community often addresses the collective nature of their interpretations and even creations, external models of intellectual ownership remain prevalent when it comes to individual fan works. Focusing on the intellectuality that diffuses and often defines fan communities and characterizes their fan works, I thus want to emphasize a fanish model that advocates repetition and not difference as a potentially driving aesthetic principle. So with this paper, I don't want to suggest that we replace the value placed on difference with one that emphasizes sameness, but rather acknowledge and admit in theory and possibly practice that one cannot exist without the other, and that it might behoove us to occasionally shift from studying and analyzing one to looking at the values of the other. It is here that essays such as Stauffer's focus on postcolonial criticism or Rebecca Tushnet's copy of this essay, which I love, offer not only important connections between aesthetic and legal approaches, but also new, dare say, original ways of looking at legal theory. Throughout this essay, I've understood myself as temporarily sidestepping rather than rejecting what's worth the egotistical sublime of the original genius. It is the shifted focus to approach such as reader response, affect, and community engagement that allows us to investigate the value of repetition. Thank you.
Before I knew what her paper was about, that like the only figure I've ever found completely boring and all of literary history was worth writing. I challenged her, and she did, in fact, make me find interest for them. So, all right, I have the dubious honor of going last when everyone is exhausted. Thank you so much for sticking around. Consolation is you get to look at props. So, I have this book to circulate. And hopefully it can make the rounds. It'll be a little noisy when you open the evidence packet. Please be circulated. It's really fun. Open up the evidence packet inside if you like. Okay, I'm Sarah Stauffer. I'm methodologically schizophrenic. I'm here today with my cultural theorist and feminist hat on, more than my legal hat, because it's a funny looking hat. Oh, good. Okay, this talk is an excerpt from a longer paper I'm working on that discusses the marketing and content of the first two installments in a trilogy of novels for teen girls. The third one is on its way via Amazon, so I'm excited. It's just been released. Collectively, the trilogy contains Kathy's book, which is circulating, Kathy's Key, and Kathy's Ring. The books are the fictional diaries of a young woman, Kathy Vickers. They contain her thoughts, her many drawings, occasional transcripts of emails, texts, IM messages. A lot of people blog about how it's the first work that contained a sort of dialogue of IM in print. I'm not sure if it's true. The narration centers on her attempts, along with her entrepreneurial best friend, Emma, to solve a mystery that has arisen around her boyfriend, Victor. Get some water. Just something from the evidence packet. There are all sorts of things. This Chinese takeout menu, there are birth certificates. There are all sorts of things that allude to a brick-and-mortar world outside the fictional story. I won't spoil the plot for you, just in case you decide you want. Has anyone read it? Okay. Yeah, it's not the right market. But I won't spoil the plot for you in case you decide to read it. The book purports to be an ARG, an ARG, or alternative reality game, though there are many who would claim it falls short of that, partly because it's not sufficiently player-driven. It's really much more of a closed hermeneutic system where players or readers sort of plug in codes that they've derived from the text, strings of numbers, things like that, and then they arrive at a correct answer, but they're not actually changing the outcome of the game or story. In this project, I consider the effects of gendered elements of the marketing on modes and consequences of downstream creativity. What I mean by gendered marketing is that the marketing doesn't simply appeal to gender. It performs it with the hope of creating it in its consumers, driving it in a particular way. I do have some data, I posit the author's gendered prepackaging of the fan experience stifles creativity, commercializes young girls' identity formation, and ultimately impoverishes the trilogy's fan culture. Now, I've been at a loss to find that fan culture, and this is one thing that I come to this conference as an outsider to fandom, so I welcome in particular methodological suggestions about how I find these fan cultures. I will say I have a slide at the very end that shows just a very primitive chart of data I've been compiling on the standard kind of public sites, but so far I've been unable to find a single piece of fan fiction, which is remarkable when you consider that this book, the first book, debuted on the New York Times bestseller list and has thousands and thousands of fans online and thousands of posts in the corporate-run fan website. Kathy's book arrived on the young adult fiction scene in 2006. It was an immediate bestseller. It's had a cult following. From its conceptualization right up through its current marketing, its authors, Sean Stewart and Jordan Weissman, men, have aggressively marketed the trilogy in a way that blended fashion, creativity, self-presentation, the body, and gender. These are some of Kathy's drawings. I meant to show you these along the way. Just notice the emphasis on portraiture. Okay, this is from the Kathy's Book UK website. You notice right away that a lot of it is about grooming, makeup, self-presentation of the female body in a particular kind of way. As I've said, I'm new to fan studies, so I'll explain what first drew my attention to trilogy was the hullabaloo that arose after publication when it was revealed that the hardcover of Kathy's book, the one that's circulating, contained a few prominent product placements. So this requires a little bit of background, but I think it's helpful since it ties into the way the works were marketed and indeed their gender dimensions. The placements advertised CoverGirl mascara. For those of you who have them in your hands, they're pages 45, 66, 67 and 76. So when they circulate, look for those, particularly 76 and 67, easy to remember. So there was a different color, a generic makeup color listed, and turned out Procter & Gamble's marketing company got wind of these works, were really interested in them, and said, hey, tell you what, why don't you put CoverGirl brand colors in, which is how they are in the hardcover, and we'll give you some free promotion on our website for girls called beinggirl.com. And the motto is, for girls, by girls. Yeah, right. This is the website. Now, a few things are going to jump out at you. This is beinggirl.com. The brands you see are always in Tampax, and many people in the room know what those stand for. Note that the way, actually, let me point out one other thing about the product placements for those of you who have books circulating. They occur in drawings that Kathy is alleged to have done, so in her diary, and they're these sort of stylized pictures of Kathy in her disguises. So she's a kind of sleuth in the story, and she dresses and makes herself up in a particular way. And she gives herself a name, like Respectable Drone Girl. That's where the R's come from in my title. That wasn't just my name, it was hers. Archphone Girl and Phone Girl. Right? But the one place where we don't have the added R's is in the CoverGirl branded references, which, just by way of a punchline about that product placement, those dropped out in the paperback because there was such a furor, such a public outcry about the product placements. But the promotion lives on. Now, what struck me as I traveled a bit further into the world of Kathy's book, Fans, and fandom is how gendered the whole enterprise was. It might not surprise you because of the sanitary products and the makeup. Okay, but other clues kept surfacing, raising first my suspicions and then my hackles about what this male-male authorial team was up to. So here the guy's kind of smiling. Importantly, the animating concept Weissman and Stewart had was heightened reader engagement. That's what they were working for. After all was said and done, or written in this case, they then involved a female illustrator. Now, stay with me a second. She's confusingly also called Kathy Brigg. She did the iconic drawings that really define the works and that have attracted fans. For some reason, they're out of order. So you saw the picture of the portraiture earlier. Kathy's role, Kathy the character, as mater familias for the trilogy's fans, her role can't be understated in terms of its effects on her fans. She has a presence on MySpace, Facebook, Flickr, DoubleTalkWireless.com, which is the official fan website. It's named after Emma, Kathy's best friend's entrepreneurial company. So it's supposed to be an entrepreneurial venture founded by a teenage girl, and it's, here it is, and it's the gateway to fandom. Here are some more of Kathy's drawings. This is the Double Talk Wireless. You have to plug in a code in order to get to some of the documents that are contained online. And that's supposed to be a picture of Emma. And the forum you can get to without a password. So you go there, and there, just for your interest, there are about 12,300 postings and about 2,300 registered posters and more guests than that. I'm not sure how large a fandom that is in comparison. I mean, I know it's tiny compared with Hannah Montana, but we can talk more about that in Q&A. It's important to note that Kathy Vickers, so she's the character, says in her posting that she also emails fans, a book should be something we all do together, me and my friends, you and yours. Note this emphasis on the kind of collaborative community nature of creativity and participation coming from, again, sort of two men, puppet masters behind the scenes, right? And it just contrast that, if you will, with Casey, right, described, your description of fan-generated spaces and how different it feels when this is not a fan who's writing this and who's sort of inviting you in to participate with her. Now, Kathy also posts infrequent but noteworthy announcements within the forum, and they also always go out on her social networking sites as well. These announcements function as ads for upcoming work or solicitations for fan art. Hers is the voice of officialdom. Fans are encouraged to produce artistic renderings and submit them to an online gallery. This makes me so skeptical. And she says, submit them and I will showcase those I like best. It's something that I call she sort of says, winkingly, this is my prestigious gallery link. My slides are all messed up. I had some slide malfunctions. I'm not sure that. Besides bestowing fake prestige on her readers for their submissions, Kathy dangles the possibility that she may even reproduce these in her next book. And indeed, she did so with three or four of the two dozen or so that are posted. Three or four of them actually made it into this book at the very end, which is interesting, but also a bit cackle-raising, which we'll get to. Now, Kathy is also involved. She's also active on beinggirl.com. Where she says she was commissioned, so she's still as this teenage artist talking in her persona, she says she was commissioned to produce artwork for P&G, Procter & Gamble, thus offering a pragmatic view of the conditions of artistic production in the real world. Signally, the cartoons solicited by P&G are all on the theme of menstruation, thus underscoring the centrality of gender within the trilogy's marketing agenda. So Laura moved all the way from UTI to having a period. And here, I'll just note in passing, this is these are the four that she's posted. She has commentary. Here's a close-up of it. In the paper, I offer readings of the cartoons, which are grotesque depictions of stereotypes about menstruation involving binge eating, chocolate, bad moods, inauthentic excuses to boys, basically I have a headache kinds of things, and a character, this PMS character, who looks like a cross between Casper the Friendly Ghost and Betty Boop. The upbeat corporate slogan Kathy had to incorporate functions as a hyper jolly exclamation mark on the whole thing. The theme that she had to work with was, we all deserve a happy period. Vitamakers, Roxy Vitamakers and Champ Packs, always. These cartoons also emblematize the way fans' expressions solicited to particular ends through the trilogy's fan infrastructure. And here's where I really start to get skeptical. I don't have the screenshot right here, but posted right next to this, where it is on the beinggirl.com website, Kathy writes, so tell me, what do you think? I'm interested in your thoughts. And fans' responses are constrained by the physical space online. Their options to tell her what they thought are to vote like, thumbs up, or nothing at all. So vote like, Barb, Shakespeare, the rest is silent. Pre-filled ballot speaks volumes about the way the trilogy treats its fans. Speak up, it seems to tell them, but only when spoken to, and only when you say what we want to hear. Through a series of coercive communication strategies that map onto gender, the trilogy's fandom is boxed into an expressive corner, time after time, web page after web page. I don't have time to detail all such instances or strategies, but can elaborate on some of them in the Q&A if you're interested. I'm just going to mention two. Now, the first is what I'll call teleological polling, end-driven polling, which drives fans to answer questions about their identities, preferences, or passions in a particular gendered, consumerist way. Okay, so if you look at this slide, this is on meangirl.com, you'll see this is polling not designed to generate productive, open-ended, or autonomous expression, but to channel responses to prefab selections that correspond with patterns of consumption in alignment with P&G's corporate goals. If you look here, the question that the poll asks you is, ew, forget sweats, is a better statement. I'd rather smell like, and then your choices are, flowers, because I'm beautiful, like Hawaiian violet or Spanish rose fruits, because they are sweet, like Brazilian cherry or Asian pear spices, because I can be mellow or wild, like vanilla chai, all three, I like to change it up. Different senses, totally me. The suggestion here is, these slightly bizarre options for what one might want to smell like, it goes without saying, contrast with ew, sweat, right? But they correspond to P&G branded scents and antiperspirant, of course, right? Those are options that you, those are options that you see in the secret brand line. But these replies are constrained, channeled into a particular answer that delimits the sort of identity a responder can have. For instance, where is the none of the above, I want to smell like sweat option? That wouldn't be what I would do.
The marketing team does these polls for trilogy themes and characters as well. Whom are you most like, Kathy, Emma, Victor, or Carla? Well, what if you want to be like Kathy's mother or some other minor character altogether? This strikes me as problematic. That was the first strategy. The second is solicitation of judging of fan texts, also disturbing. In one section of the Kathy's Key website, up here on the screen, Kathy posts Kathy's Key Dehydrated, she calls it, which refers to the collection of drawings included in the second volume with none of the prose. Kathy solicits, quote, your best guesses as to what might be happening to induce those drawings. She says she will probably post some of the best ones. But what does best mean? Those that most accurately align with the pictures? Perhaps. Those that resist, pervert, transform, differ from them? Probably not. Kathy is asking that you complete a task as though able to read her mind. She's conditioning you to guess what she might like. This is what literature professors might call hiding the ball. Law professors call it the Socratic dialogue. Rather than stimulating creativity of an open-ended type, then, Kathy seeks creativity of a fill-in-the-blank kind. She mediates the content thus on two levels. First, by soliciting a particular input of a particular sort, fill-in-the-blank, rehydrate my novel, guess what inspired my creativity, and second, by publishing only those responses she deems worthy. Just try to imagine for a moment if J.K. Rowling held regular contests encouraging fans to submit their artwork to her and announcing that she might publish some of the portraits she liked in her next Harry Potter book. Now, I said next Harry Potter book, but we're in a hypothetical, so stick with it. Imagine the effect it would have. Isn't it just possible that fans would have had the incentive to produce work that she would like? Unless a mediator, say Rowling here, Kathy, would be looking for work, unless a mediator would be looking for work that is subversive or disobedient in Sonia Katil's language, or outside the box in some other way, the fan works that will survive the politics of publication will be cooperative, compliant, performative of the good girl identity that the team is trying to induce. Marketing through a mode of scarcity and prestige, i.e., too many guesses for me to publish them all, even though our forum is online and it would be cheap to do so, heightens the desire, as Rebecca pointed out, heightens the desire for fans to participate. That participation becomes subordinated and co-opted, however, through the mediation of Kathy's top-down valuation and hegemonic power of selection. Now, scholars have written about how relaxing certain rights restrictions in the Jamban context appears to lead to greater fan cooperation and respect for artists' rights. Here we see that kind of logic being used to shape, mediate, and sublimate fans' appetite for creative responses that might stand in opposition to the marketing team's goals or might simply differ from them. In short, fans are being directed to act the part of the good girl either through passive, constrained, non-creative engagement or through creative but accommodating endeavors. I'm coming to my conclusion here. I know I'm over, so I apologize. The conclusion is called Effects of Gendered Marketing and My Many-Hatted Concerns. So I've got my woman's hat on now. I have a couple of concerns with what I've been thinking of as gendering girls into submission in their fanish identity creation and expression. The first is an old problem, right? It's the McGrawby and Garver problem of worrying that girls will be present but invisible, and especially here in a top-down, male-dominated infrastructure, right? They're just ticking off a poll, but obviously the men at P&G developed for them to tell them they want to smell like chai. The second problem is only a slightly newer problem. It's the extent of mapping patterns of consumption onto body loathing, either cultivated or exacerbated by this kind of marketing. Example, video quiz, right? Why do we want to smell like chai or Brazilian cherry rather than just smelling like sweat? In connection with an immortality subplot, if I spoiled something, not that I think after this any more videos could have been but the first novel is actually interesting. The second one gets quite a bit more misogynistic. But, there's an immortality subplot in here, and so one of the connected websites to this work features a plastic surgeon, and there's a subplot about a plastic surgeon. Now, by way of conclusion, I just want to read you some language that has raised cause for alarm for me. Kathy and Emma have just sneaked into the plastic surgeon's office that I mentioned. Kathy is dressed in a bimbo outfit from where she works. It's Swiss Miss outfit that allows bystanders to glimpse and comment on her plump globals. They see a bunch of before and after pictures of women who have undergone procedures, and as I read this, recall that the prose is written by a woman. So there she's looking at the pictures. Here we have Kathy's voyeuristic gaze filtered through Sean Stewart's language. As for the women, One thing you learn if you draw a lot of portraits is that, as far as the pencil is concerned, age and gravity are basically the same thing. This is what happens to women. We sag. Our boobs droop and our ankles get thick as extra weight slowly pools at the bottom of our legs. Some of us get little pot bellies low down on our abdomens. The little bit of rather attractive fat in the hollows above our eyes mysteriously moves down to become extra chins or jowls or even wattles if we are unlucky. But the happy after women in these photographs had tight, perky faces and big, perky boobs that bravely ignored gravity and looked as if they would do so perpetually if only the women would keep smiling. Looking around these photographs, I realized it wasn't just beauty the good doctor was selling, it was youth. At least I recognize that somebody's selling something in here. So as a cultural theorist, I have a whole section here I won't get into, just to say that I argue that in part on the basis of post-structuralist theory, namely that the thing cannot logically contain its supplement, since the supplement works to address gaps in the thing, I'm about to explain what that means, and this harkens back to Tisch's point about the relationship between vids and their source works, this is a problem for fan works to be contained within the fan object. And Francesca and Gail have written about this, both the supplement and the archive. But translating this into English that we can all understand, the source work cannot contain its fan text because fan texts derive meaning and being from being external to the source, from addressing its gaps, mysteries, problems, inconsistencies, and opportunities. Instead, Kathy's book brings its fans in-house. And indeed, that externality is what, I think it's Susan, right? You said something about the fan text's authenticity. That's what makes them authentic, right? That they're external. Instead, Kathy's book brings its fans in-house. The book's readers are meant to become appreciative consumers and producers of cooperative forms of creativity. In other words, they're assigned the role of the good girl, the collaborator, the good fan. If we build on, and I have like six lines left, we build on Kurt Lancaster's notion of fans as textual performers, we can avoid the problem of casting fans as either consumers or producers, what Matt Hills has described as the good fan versus bad consumers problem. This is an especially important reminder in this context. But if these performances are being constrained, as if the marketing team is directing these fans' performances, I think something important is lost. I join in the chorus of post-John Fiske fans' voices that say that fans need not produce subversive work for it to matter or to count. But I do think autonomy, which is not the same thing as subversion, is crucial to maintain, right? For all the dignitarian reasons that Anne Bardo laid out in her great comments earlier. As for IP policy, which I try to take up in the conclusion of my paper, one line, if we buy the incentive story for the purpose of copyright law that it seeks to incentivize artistic creation, should give us real pause. If corporate co-option of fandom, especially in a cynically gendered fashion, can stifle fan responses through gendered strategies of communication, and control, and this recalls Anne's comments about the political dimensions of community building. We might, by conclusion, turn the beinggirl.com slogan back on itself in prescribing a preferable alternative. It claims to be by girls, for girls. Fandom, I want to argue, albeit in my guise as an outsider to it, should be by fans and for fans.
Great. Well, Stacy will try to get the connection with Abigail back up, and in the meantime, let's start with questions for Christina and Czar. Who would like to begin? So I've got a question for everyone that grows out of Czar's presentation, and that is the question of whether or not by community standards, this is or isn't a success, whether or not this attempt to generate a synthetic fan community measures up to the real thing. Obviously, in some sense, this enterprise has been a success because they've sold a lot of books. But what about the supplement?
Based on what you say is the success of the books, the size of that fan community doesn't seem very large. So I would say that it is missing a mark. I mean, clearly someone is posting there, but for the books to be that popular, I would expect there to be much more participation in the website.
Well, and if you've never found a single piece of fanfic anywhere online,
at all. I just did a quick and dirty search. I didn't find it, in the usual kind of odds where we... Nothing at the Pitiful, nothing in New York, nothing at Scared, nothing on Ice Market, nothing.
I have
not yet, anyway. I mean, it was 10 minutes.
And it's places I live, fanfiction.net, MySpace, Facebook, YouTube, LiveJournal, Girl.com, GirlZone.com, Sweetie.com, and a few other places, but these are the ones where we compile information. And there are two communities on LiveJournal.com and 48 interested users, but no fanfic. I've also posted in the forum myself a long time ago requesting fanfics and talking about it and haven't heard anything.
I wonder about that in the sense of, it seems like these fanfic communities would feel incredibly ripped off and denigrated, or at least some people in them. And I'm wondering about why it wouldn't have prompted a critical, I mean, like a concerted attack. Why they wouldn't be like, look at this terrible things they're doing to us, and then, you know, not just parodies of them, but you know, vehement attacks.
We don't care.
Yeah,
I really care about this book. I mean, my son has tons of books that I would, you know, they get read and they get sold and the kids love them, and then they're gone, and like, why would I care?
Can I elaborate on that? Because I think that says something really important about the fan experience, which is to say, we might criticize something we love, but if you don't have the initial investment in the starting place, you're not, in other words, that's work, right? In other words, you don't get my kind of paid cultural critique for free. It is only with the kind of tremendous investment.
Of course.
I just want to
say that.
Can I just say that this may be the first academic paper that was actually selected in part by a 15-year-old. We were reviewing all of the submissions over Christmas break, and so my stepdaughter was with us at home, and so, you know, I said to her, what do you think of this? And she engages in quite a bit of you know, online life, and we went and looked at a copy of the book at Barnes & Noble, and she looked at me and she goes, it seems fake, and like that was without. You know, that was without me, you know, saying, because I just sort of wanted the unbiased 15-year-old take, and that was what she gave me. She was just like, it just doesn't seem like it was made by girls.
But see,
and she smelled it.
And I feel like I want to kind of add the gender piece to it, because Jonathan and I had a really, I thought, very interesting conversation at the last conference we were at, where we were talking about, Jonathan was saying that in his remix community, which is largely male-dominated, people do critical work. So the point of the work is exclusively critical or celebratory works, but they didn't have the necessarily female hybrid of, I love it, but I had a small issue, or I love it, but I wish this were different, or, you know, it always sort of starts with, I care a whole lot, but they didn't give me enough, I don't know, with a, you know, Kathy Victor, right? I really want to hear Kathy Victor's Adventures Through Europe, right? They didn't give that to me, so I'm going to supplement this thing I love. But part of it was when he said that, I was sort of like, you mean people in your community have things they love uncritically? You mean that there are things that you feel are made just for you that you can enjoy without finding the need? And you know, if I say I like this book, I assume you understand that I mean, aside from the fact that it's racist. Right? I mean, yes, are we going to put that aside? Yes, I loved it. It was a great movie. I just saw it the other night. Of course it was racist. Of course the women were. There was one woman. She wore high heels. She was marginalized. She was pushed off to the side. I still liked it. I mean, you see, if I didn't like that, I wouldn't watch anything. You see what I'm saying? And if I didn't do fan culture, then yeah. What would I do? Right? How would I enjoy any popular culture at all? But I had that sense that maybe guys didn't feel that way. So this may explain partly if there's not sufficient,
well,
you know, investment.
I still feel somewhat puzzled because I mean, when you hear people who love the works talking about it, I mean, one of the things they love, and actually reader advocates have loved it because it's gotten teens reading, right? And they even in response to the product placement critics have said, well, who cares? It's getting them reading. You're missing the point. But if you look at them, I mean, there's a lot of work that's been put into these texts. I mean, it took them 2 or 3 years to get a book deal. That's one of the reasons they were sort of open to the product placement when it finally came along, because nobody wanted to print something, nobody wanted to go to press with something that had all of these images, the evidence packs, very expensive to make. I mean, the only reason I have copies of them is because I found them in a remainder place for a couple bucks, but they're like $16, $17 to buy, and even that, you know, was, so I think that some girls respond to this
as a place that emphasizes female creativity. I did not mention the positive things, like Emma, who is the girl whose website, you know, Don't Talk Wireless, represents her Chinese mainland cell phone company, is an entrepreneur. She's really good at math and science. She's really brainy. There are all sorts of things that are positive in there. All I did,
What's the target group? What's the age? Because I think that's a problem. I mean, is the age
young teenagers?
Or girls?
I mean, I've also compiled. Compiled data, again, not like Melissa's, but, you know, informal survey of MySpace and Facebook users, self-reported, so problematic, but usually when you see the ones who are 99, you go, okay, they're, you know, teens. But there are a lot of people, 18, 19, 20, 26, who are fans of this, you know, hundreds on MySpace. It's a small community, but self-reported, and my research assistant very kindly tracked a bunch of them down and actually looked to sort of verify, does the self-reporting to be fairly accurate, i.e., if they're 18 or 19, do they also list a college affiliation, and they did. There was a fair amount of it. So I think there's a lot of looking beyond the sexism in here, and that's why I brought it to the fore. I noticed it much less in the first than in the second with that horrendous body-loading language.
Please.
It doesn't seem like the type of book that actually is going to attract fan fiction, whereas it may attract fan art that maybe was submitted and not accepted. So I would check DeviantArt and maybe other fan art-oriented websites, or people who are maybe not drawing the exact illustrations that are called for on the website, but are making other documents.
Yeah, like that's more how they are.
Yeah.
But they don't seem deviant. I would love to be able to interview Kathy and say, how much are you turning away? And this goes back to Rebecca's question about kind of the rhetoric of scarcity and whether there are thousands of people whose artwork isn't being selected or whether all 14 of the, you know, have been posted.
But if it sells, why isn't it a success? I mean, why are we defining success in terms of how much fan work is creating? I mean, is that a success measurement? It's only success measurement if it can, you know, give you new customers. But if they're already buying the books.
I guess I was trying in the initial question to distinguish between two kinds of success. There is obviously a commercial success, perhaps even for all we know, an artistic success associated with the book itself. But the specter, or one of the specters that the essay raises, is the possibility of commercial co-optation of the kinds of fan spaces that we have been talking about today. And for that specter to be a matter of increasing concern, it would be interesting to know that it could be demonstrated that this attempt to create a synthetic fan community has actually prospered in some way. I don't dismiss the concern.
Well, the question about success might be measured from the marketer's perspective and the fan's perspective, right? Yeah. I mean, I found one reference. So there are more than 12,000 postings, and I've read a couple thousand, probably. So I still have work to do. But I found one reference pretty prominently that said, hey, guys, I'm thinking about starting up my own website so we can have our own chatting about this sort of stuff. What do you think? And a couple people were like, yeah, PM me if you do. Cool, awesome. And then one person comes in and says, wouldn't that just replicate what we have here? And someone else goes, yeah, kind of true, but, you know, let me know if you decide to do it. And the other person's like, a lot of work, and then it goes away. So I don't know if this really functioned successfully from the marketing perspective as a way of sublimating the desire for an autonomous space.
Yeah.
I just thought of a few homologues. Do you remember Lonely Girl? Did you YouTube? Some people who were trying to launch a television show.
Yes. Yes.
Lonely Girl. It was supposed to be for real. They played it around, but it was fake. And everyone I knew who saw it thought it was way too smooth to be real. You know, couldn't figure out what was going on until it was finally real. We kind of predicted that, but it was wildly popular. The other thing that happens. Is it's more subtle, I guess, is in blog, like the blogs that I follow. If you read regularly, like for example, there's one feminist blog where a woman did several detailed and really good, I thought wonderfully written and informative posts about bras, about sizing and fitting and just her own experience, and it just really seemed authentic. And then I noticed within days there were links to bra buying sites in her ad. Now she always ran ads, and she was open about running ads. But there were the links to bras, and I just go, oh man, like, but you know, on the other hand, I respect her right to try to make some money out of her writing. It's just always, you know, kind of a balance. I don't know.
Do we have Abigail? Are you with us?
Abigail? Have Abigail.
Can I steal the mic off the podium there?
Hi, Abigail. Sorry.
Hi.
I thought I might try to ask, I don't know if you've been hearing the conversation, but you know, when we were putting the panels together, one of the things we were thinking about is the ways in which all the different panelists talked about value and the creation of value. And one of the kind of conversations that I was sort of hoping to stage, right, is we have Abigail on the one side talking about profiting from fan works or what it would mean. And here we have other people profiting from something that looks like fan works, right? And to the extent to which you're talking about implicitly, the Kathy's book, right, is creating value in it gets kids to read. Like, that's a value worth paying for. And it stages positive feminine values. And that's a value worth paying for. And of course, those of us in fandom might think of, you know, a good community moderator, or a good archivist, or a good list moderator, or any number of ways in which fandom, I mean, Jenkins has written about this too, right, of kids reading because they find fan fiction and all of this, and yet we don't seem to find that kind of value. Or so I guess I want to kind of throw it to Abigail, sort of wondering if you want to weigh in on the value. I mean, I like what you were saying. Like, we possibly have given away too much too soon while questions of value are still being renegotiated. But to what extent does fandom have some of these values that the men who have made Kathy's book seem to have no problem at all? You know, even if they say, hey, you know, for $17 you get this book and your kids get to be in this positive educational experience, well, we teach kids a lot of things, I think, in fandom, but certainly critical thinking and reading against the text and writing skills and point of view, close reading.
You know what? I would rather have that 12-year-old be in this artificial environment than be in my fandom. I mean, I've got to say that. You know, this is young children. And so that protected space may not be the worst thing. And I know I'm going to
bring
a lot of people now, but
it's okay. You know, we'll tackle it. I sort of feel, let's get maybe Abigail, what do you think about the question of value?
Okay, so the question is something about whether the value that fans are creating has been co-opted by sort of official media producers like the writers of Kathy's book. Is that sort of
I would say
that in general, one thing that fan fiction authors have basically invented is the extension of text in a published way, in a public way. I'm not sure if this exactly addresses the Kathy's book question, but I think what the authors of Kathy's book have done is a very mild, a mild form of co-optation, mild compared to what BS, ABC, NBC have done, mild compared to what movie studios have done, in creating an official website on which fans could participate, creating extension of their texts, creating blogs that characters offer. Creating ways that fans can upload, you know, full scenarios, full stories, invent characters, invent things. It seems to me that more and more what we used to call fanfiction has become the norm for participatory culture surrounding official media patterns. So I think that one reason that fanfiction has more cease and desist letters than, say, fan novel, has been that fanfiction has been co-opted by movie studios, and not, you know, fanfics are obviously not part of the Star Wars universe. They don't extend the Star Wars narrative, whereas fanfiction totally is a way of getting deeper into the already existing texts. So that's my sort of take on fanfiction creates tons of value. It has created protocols for interactivity. It has created a way for extending franchises, deepening them, really accruing a lot of interest in existing narratives. And I think that Kathy's book, yeah, gives kind of just a little boost.
I want to kind of supplement this or give another example.
I want to supplement this and give another example. Louisa has an essay forthcoming in Cinema Journal where she talks about Calyx Y fandom, which is completely commercial, more or less. There is not much otherwise there. And they created they created a character, a fan. And this fan had a blog and had a website, and he was engaging with other fans. And then it turned out that he actually was an employee. And then he turned out to be named like a character that then showed up in the show. So there was this entire
immersion of show narrative, and I mean these diegetic spaces were all mixed in together. And the thing that was interesting, and what I found really fascinating in her paper and her research, was that the fans didn't mind. Her millennial fan, the current teens, I don't know if they're just so disenchanted or if they just, you know, commerciality is part of it. They didn't care. They actually were, you know, so he's fake. Who cares? And so it wasn't this, you know, this is inauthentic or we're disappointed or, you know, they just continued on their merry way and continued on with the tasks and the, you know, plays and whatever was on the website and engaged with him continually.
I mean, to bring your point into it too, you were talking about repetition and difference, and you know the extent to which that could become a value judgment, right? And one of the things about the non-commerciality of fandom is that it sort of isn't a value judgment, or at least the values are different to the extent to which we're happy to read the same story with different. I mean, it's never the same.
Sadly, the part that I cut out was the part where it was talking about the fans and how fans have this really weird schizophrenia where in our discourses we value originality and in our reading habits a lot of us value repetition. So if you look at what gets, you know, what gets praised as this great work and then what gets marked on delicious, a lot of things are not quite the same, and I'm sure, you know, we all have been there. So I think we have this discourse that we've inherited. And at the same time, you know, our reading affect a lot of times gets us someplace else.
So as somebody who's concerned about this sort of astroturfing, I guess, of fan spaces, right, what they call, as opposed to grassroots, instead, you know, you get the corporate. Ellen Goodman in Law has written about the sort of epistemic harms to a system of not being able to trust that you're in a space that is proceeding in good faith as if it were, you know, a fan. So I find that troubling. I find it, even if you don't want your 12-year-old in Supernatural fandom, I'm not sure you want them on the Tampax website either. Because that's not a neutral space in any way.
Supernatural fandom. They just can't see anything. Right. They can't focus on this anymore.
Right.
You know?
But the thing that strikes me about the Kyle XY example is I think we may also be attributing indifference to commerciality to a group that instead has a different perspective about identity. That is, one of the things Dana Boyd has this great dissertation where she talks about how teenagers expect to encounter fake identities,
right,
because they've been told make your own identity fake so that you'll be protected from predators.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not necessarily to say that they don't care about commerciality, but that they don't expect people, necessarily anybody, to be who they say they are. And especially when we're in a space where you're performing yourself, it may be okay to encounter other people who are performing themselves. However, that said, I want to be the traditional, you know, high ground fan and say, look, I think this strategic use of separate spaces is important, and it's important in particular to preserving our ability to say things that the content owners may not like, because I'm not sure that what we get from opening up the payment discussion is worth what we're going to lose. I'm not sure who's supposed to pay me for my stuff. I'm not sure I want to take money from other women who, by the way, are probably make less money than I do. I don't know why. I'm confident that you know, Supernatural is never going to pay me. So non-commerciality, in our schizophrenic sense, I think may well be worth the trade.
Yeah, I think that sort of base argument there should is limited to craftsmanship, which is what's meaningful about getting a quilt someone that, you know, they made that quilt for you. I mean, that's so much more valuable they made it for you, gave it to you, than that you bought a quilt off the mass manufacturer, you know, shelf. There are certainly many, many questions about how would fans possibly get paid for their labor. That certainly has not been answered. No solution has been posited in any decent way. But when you consider the level of frustration occupation and have with official produced tech, the amount of work they put in to customize those tech to make them more satisfactory, not just for themselves, but for other patrons. The fact that fan fiction, fan fiction, mass media, the fact that they uphold the temple of media franchises that are worth billions of dollars, it just seems ridiculous that, but it absolutely, from the outset, negates the idea that we should pay for our contributions out of economy.
I have one for you, Chris.
Peter, can you talk into the microphone?
Oh, but of course. So, one of the things that I took from your essay was a warning that those of us who are involved in the legal side of this discussion should be cautious about this category of transformativeness, which has emerged as a word of power in the law over the last 15 or 20 years because of its association with the sort of rather strongly male gendered ideas of originary genius. And do you think that that association is an inevitable one? Or do you think that with work we could sever that association and expand that category in ways that would give space and recognition to the kinds of practices, the participatory practices that we've been discussing here today?
I deconstructed myself at lunch after Trisha's paper on when she said, you know, any repetition is already transformative, I realized, oh yeah, that like completely negates my paper on some level. And I was even invoking Derrida there on the linguistic level, and I didn't take it to the next level. So in a way, I guess you could invoke transformative and encompass that. I think the problem is that we don't do that. And I'm not talking about OTW specifically, but I think that, you know, as I said, even within the fan community, we have a tendency to do one thing but then praise another and to kind of only praise that side. I mean, you very rarely see people. I mean, I have friends that I like just email with Rex. I would never post them on my Life Journal because it's like, you know, the bad stories. It's the, you know, but it's that celebration, it's the affect, it's the, you know, and those tend to be the repetitive stories.
I feel like I want to disagree. Like, I feel like we're not using those words in the ways, I don't know if this is working. I don't know if we're using those words the way they're customarily used when we say. I mean, for instance, you know, I feel like I'm sort of speaking up a little bit for OTW in the archive here. But every story is different. Like, there are whole new words in it, all in different order. I'm not joking about that. I mean, there's not any plagiarism. You're not often repeating same scenes whole cloth. Even tropes or genres. I mean, bookstores are full of genre fiction that are very similar, and that's not a negative. And in fact, I feel that, depending on how you define it, difference, as you say, not just the kind of difference that you're saying, you're almost implying, like, well, a story, you know, I like wrecking, you know, I might praise a different story, but I really like the same ones. I think actually that's very common in fandom. And in fact, a story that's too different, like,
right,
you kill everyone at the end, or
that's what I said.
No, I'm not saying everyone dies. You're doing something very strange, or you're doing something,
Hamlet.
Yeah, Hamlet. You're doing something highly literary, or you're doing something as a formal experiment. A lot of people might be like, yeah, but I, you know, give me a good, solid, you know, adventure yarn with a, you know, third act climax, a nice romance, a happy ending on a boat, you know? All right. So I feel like, I don't know that I necessarily believe that we're using the right terminology. I think I think even movies, I mean, the sequelitis is about selling sameness very successfully, very profitably, you know, Die Hard 4, 5, 6.
But we don't aesthetically reward it. I mean, when we talk about aesthetics, it's always about, you know, genre literature is derogatory.
Sure, but I mean, what I guess I'm saying is the canon building of literary studies and transformation in the terms of something that OTW would protect. I think when I talk about a transformative work, I do not mean the canonical class. I am not, you know, I feel like the organization does not intend to protect the top 10 best, most original fan fiction stories in a way that, as an English professor, I might well at some point want to do a nice little textbook of 10 fan fiction stories that right. people could use to right. teach with that are original in some sort of a way. But I think that those are different paradigms that I just don't want to conflate too
much. Maybe I just want to caveat, because I think that, you know, since I see this discourse occurring again and again that emphasizes, you know, we don't want too much repetition, we want the newness, we want the difference, and we want the... that I kind of, I want us to value.
But again, in genre fiction, I mean, in fact, you know, you're buying something based on a cover that looks like other, I mean, I feel like we as fans, if you like genre, if you like a mystery, we
but do. Actually, I kind of think that aesthetically, especially if we're mapping this onto the law at all, we might want to think about divorcing anything to do with copyright and think about trademark. It seems to me that those sequels are about marks, not about copyrights. I mean, I know that the property rights are not bearing out what I say, but insofar as sequels, some people have done work on this, I'm thinking of Laura Heyman on the Authornym, but insofar as certain kinds of works and formulas just transmit reliability, I mean, that's sort of what the genre is doing. It's functioning more like a trademark than a copyright, and in some sense that's helpful if we can then use the copyright as a place to work out kind of aesthetic thing. I don't know. I mean,
right.
there are problems with what I'm saying. I'm just laying it out there.
Well, in response to what Christina was saying about privileging originality over repetition, even to some extent, Wordsworth wasn't doing that, and you said that his whole thing was built on how a truly original work has to create the taste it will be judged by. That means that it depends on repetition. It just depends on repetition that comes afterwards. It means it's still part of a genre. It's just one that hasn't been
it has created yet.
So, I mean, Wordsworth was actually acknowledging that you had to have a genre dialogue, you had to have tropes, you had to have repetition to have proper appreciation, just acknowledging that that can be preceding or
following. Yeah, but the repetition isn't valued. Only his work is valued. I mean, that's
well,
the idea.
Right, but he said that the value comes when the repetition does, essentially. Creates the taste it will be judged by means it's valued when it's repeated.
But the repetition isn't valued. It's the original that's valued. I think that makes the difference.
Yes.
Questions? Let's thank the panel very much, and in particular. I wanted to repeat.
Yes, thank you.
Maybe I can grab that.
Yeah, see, it might turn out working so well. This one seems to work. That's okay.
Okay, great. So let me just repeat again the thanks that Anne gave this morning to Angie Stacey, Mike and Meredith, and Joe, and all of the other heroes and heroines from APNIT. And to Daniela, without whom this would not have been possible. And to a couple of absent friends who wanted to be here but could not, Sean Flynn, the executive director of Bishop, and Vicki Phillips, who is running another conference today, but who has been a mainstay of this event since its inception and will be going forward, and in particular, again, to Professor Gopa and to Rebecca Dushin for everything, for their contribution. And to OTW, our co-sponsoring organization, which we've heard a lot about today, and we'll hear a lot about in time to come, and whose middle name has emerged as a particular focus of attention today. I hope that going out of this room, going back into our own work on whatever side of this disciplinary mix or in whatever part of this disciplinary mix we practice, we'll strive for a while to try to keep this category of transformativeness open. I hope that we'll strive for a while not to allow it to close, not to allow its meaning to be too quickly or too fixedly associated with any one set of values or practices. Eventually, the courts may do that for us, but for now at least, we have a rare opportunity as individuals and as collectives to be heard ourselves as to what that category means. And if I had a wish for this enterprise going forward out of today, it would be that. Finally, I just wanted to note something about the distance that we've come in these kinds of discussions over time. Christina referred to Telford's bill, the British Copyright Term Extension Act that finally passed in 1842, that Wordsworth and many other eminent men of letters were active in supporting. I've got here a little volume that was published in 1840, which is three of Telford's parliamentary speeches bound together with a series of brief memorials from those different men of letters individually and collectively supporting the enterprise of copyright term extension. And I looked at lunchtime to see if I could find any trace of women in this document. In the narrative of the document, there is only one who is named. Only one woman's situation is actually referenced. We hear a lot in these memorials about how tough it is for men to have to labor under a limited copyright term, but the only actual mention of a woman and her situation is to be found in the petition of Hartley Coleridge, Esquire, the son of William Wordsworth's troublesome friend, Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And she is referred to as the aged widow of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who is dependent in large measure on the sale of his works for those comforts and that freedom from anxiety which her increasing years demand. That's about it as far as the discourse of 1842 is, or 1842 is concerned. So it seems to me we made a certain amount of progress in introducing other kinds of differently gendered considerations into the discourse of IV. I hope that these workshops have made some contribution to that progress. I hope they'll continue to do so, and I hope that you will join us again in future years. Thank you very much.